The Light of Transfiguration by Brian Craig. "Of all the stories I know," said Orfeo, with an unaccustomed softness in his voice, "the ones I love best are those set in the region where I lived as a child, which is the Lauren Forest. I wish that all the tales which I could tell of Lauren were as happy as my memories of it, but alas, it is not so. You will know the forest by repute as the abode of the virtuous wood elves, and it was by those elves that I was found and raised when I was abandoned there. But the forest is vast, and there are many others who have sought solace and shelter in its wilder parts, among them bad and dangerous men, who have increased the burden of evil and suffering which lies upon the world we love. Most of the men who live on the fringes of the forest are honest worshippers of Tal, and many of those who live closer to its heart still follow caring traditions of the old religion. But there are parts of the forest which are host to the worshippers of darker gods, and to those who make treaty with demons. One such tainted area is to be found in the lower reaches of the steep mountains called the Vaults, which I was taught in my youth to avoid. Because the wood elves do not teach without explanation, they told me all that the wisdom of lore and legend had to say about the place, and it is one tale from that legacy which I will tell you now. It is one of that sad multitude of tales which warn us to beware of the wiles of those demons which are sent by wicked gods to seduce and torment us. On one of the lesser crags of this region, near a town called Selindrei, there once stood a fortified manse, which was a centre of forbidden worship until the king, who was great-grandfather to our own beloved Charles, appointed his favourite knight, Lanval de Valancourt, to lead a crusade against the demonkin. All good Bretonians have heard the story of that great adventure, and you will know already that Lanval's courage prevailed at last against the evil magic of the sorcerer Chemis Kezula. But the version of the tale you have heard from other tellers undoubtedly ended with the moment of Lanval's victory, and with the implication that all has been well in Selindrei's domains since it was achieved. Alas, it is a truth which we too often forget, that the shadows of evil cast by dark magic often linger long after the destruction of the magicians themselves. It was because he knew this that Lanval de Valancourt, having acquired the estate of Chemis Kezula by right of lawful conquest, caused the fortress to be razed to the ground and its stones scattered about the mountainside by his men-at-arms. Lanval never set foot among the ruins again, and when the time came for him to die, which he did in his bed, as all heroes deserve to do, though few achieve it, he advised his son, Guillaume, to leave it alone also. Guillaume, being a wise man as well as a dutiful son, did as he was instructed. Guillaume lived 10 years less than his father, departing this life at the age of 52, and was misfortunate enough to die far from home, while fighting a campaign for his liege lord, the king. In consequence of this, his own son and heir, Jehan de Valancourt, acquired the lands around Selindrei without receiving any solemn warning in regard to his use of them. All his knowledge of them, in fact, was drawn from the tales of his grandfather's glorious victory, which many storytellers, less scrupulous than myself, had altered somewhat for the purposes of prettification and flattery. Jehan so loved to bask in the reflected glory of his ancestors' heroic exploits that he took an early opportunity to visit Selindrei, and was somewhat surprised to discover that the people of the town were less than grateful for the privilege of receiving him. He was a young man still, and had not quite understood how happy men can be when their liege lord live distantly and do not put them to the trouble of providing obligatory hospitality. When Jahan proudly rode up the slopes of Chemis Kazula's blasted fortress to inspect the scene of his grandfather's victory, he was unlucky enough to be thrown from his horse. He fell awkwardly, splitting his head upon a square-edged stone. Though his skull was not broken, the wound never healed. And for the remainder of his life, Jahan was tormented by evil dreams and periodic bouts of madness, during which the ordinary light of day seemed to him to be eclipsed by a brighter and more colourful light, whose constant changes made him dizzy with anxiety. Jahan became convinced that the ruins of Chemis Kazula's citadel were accursed, though whether he was mad or sane at the moment when he was persuaded of it, none can tell. For this reason, he inserted a clause into his will, which said that the hill on which the fallen fortress stood should be set aside from the domains of Selendre, and should not be handed down to his own eldest son, who was called Lanfranc. Instead, the hill was given to the sisters of Shalya, the goddess of healing and mercy, in order that they should raise in that wild and tempestuous region a shrine of their own. By means of this device, Jahan de Valancourt sought to employ the power of the best and kindest of the gods to erase the memory and the legacy of wicked Chemis Kazula, whose prayers had undoubtedly been offered to a very different deity. The sisters of Shalya were not entirely delighted to receive Jahan de Valancourt's legacy after his death. It was not that they feared any curse which might lie upon the land, but simply that the region was remote and was home to very few followers of the goddess. The Council of Couronne, after much deliberation, sent envoys to Lanfranc de Valancourt to say that the gift of land would not be useful unless he could also provide for the hire of a company of masons and carpenters to build a temple and a house upon the site. Lanfranc, despite that he harboured some slight resentment that the sisters should inherit land which might have been his, agreed to assemble such a crew from those in his service, provided that the sisters would go to the hill with them, so that their prayers and their magic could provide protection against the effects of any curse which might lie upon the land. This was agreed. In consequence of these decisions, a company of sisters was dispatched from Quinelles, travelling up the River Brienne to the limit of its navigability, where they met the Valancourt builders, whose task it would be to build the stones of Chemis Kazula's ruined manse into a residence and a temple. The nine sisters, who were appointed to this mission, accepted their lot, as they were bound by their vows to do, unquestioningly. Some, indeed, were pleased by the prospect, for Mother Thelinda, who was appointed superior of the company, there was a welcome increase in authority to compensate for the disruption of her former life. And for the likes of Sister Penelope and Sister Mirica, neither of whom had ever taken to city life, there was the lure of the forest and the fresh mountain air. But there were also those whose uncomplaining acceptance masked a certain unease. And one of these was Sister Adalia. Adalia was 22 years old, having served Shalya for 8 years. She was the daughter of a craftsman glass worker in the service of the governor of Quinelles, who had attracted the attention of a priestess of Shalya by virtue of an unusual aptitude for spell casting, which she had shown as an adolescent. Alas, her aptitude had failed to mature with her body, so that her cultivated skills proved to be nothing out of the ordinary. This disappointment had not detracted from Adalia's loyalty towards the goddess while she remained in her native town, where she was close to her relatives, and where all the best houses boasted at least one window made by her father. She was stern in her determination to avoid curiosity about what might have become of her had she taken a different path in life, She never asked herself whether it was right and fair that the dull woman she now was should inherit the consequences of decisions made by the over-eager and false-promising girl she once had been. When she was commanded to leave Quinnell's, though, she soon became conscious of a certain emptiness in the secret chamber of her heart, which her prayers and acts of charity could not begin to fill. The hardship of the early days on the slopes above Selindres could not help but magnify any unease which the sisters felt. Although it was summer, the weather was often chilly and damp, and though the builders worked as fast as they could to erect two big houses, one for themselves and one for the sisters, their progress was slow. The huge black stones, which had formed the walls of Kemis Kazula's citadel, were very difficult to shift and raise, even with block and tackle, and the tall trees which had to be felled for timber had hard, dark wood, which blunted the carpenter's drills and saws. In the meantime, the whole company shivered in their tents. Adalia, though she was far from being the tallest or the strongest of the sisters, was instructed to help the workmen in their lighter tasks, fetching and carrying for them, or mixing mortar. The work was so hard that her back always ached and her hands often bled. And though her magic won her some relief from such sufferings, there was always more work to renew them. Mirica, seeing her distress, told her gently that the sunlight and the fresh air would soon bring colour to her cheeks and more strength to her limbs. But Adalia could discover no such change in herself as the long days went by. The sisters and the workmen moved into the two houses as soon as the roofs were in place, though they were by no means entirely finished. Each of the sisters was allotted a room, bare-floored and bare-walled, with a pallet on which to sleep, and two candle brackets set on either side of a slit window. So black was the stone of which the walls were made, so narrow were the windows, and so poor were the candles manufactured in Selindres, that these rooms seemed at first to be dreadfully gloomy. Adalia's room was in the second story, beneath the eaves. It faced north, so that the sun never shone directly through the narrow window, and it overlooked a stand of uncommonly twisted trees, whose tattered crown seemed to mutter arcane imprecations when stirred by the wind. It was by no means as comfortable as the room which she had occupied in Quinnell's, whose walls had been hung with tapestries depicting flocks of flying doves, and whose latticed windows had faced the rising sun. But she was resolved that she must not hate it, and it was certainly a relief to possess some space that was all her own after weeks of sharing a tent. Mother Thalinda instructed that each of the sisters must make her room a fit place for prayer, first by staining the dark walls white, and then by inscribing on their surface the sacred symbols of Shalia, a heart of gold, a white dove in flight, and a tear-shaped drop of blood. Though none complained, all found difficulty in executing this task, for the black stones which had once protected Kemis Kazula were resistant to the stain of purity, and whitewash had to be applied several times over before the walls would condescend to be lightened. And Alia found the task particularly frustrating, but in the end achieved a shade of grey, which did not seem intolerably grimy. By this time, the white habit which she wore seemed to have lost its crisp cleanness for ever, and no matter how she scrubbed it, she could only bring it to the same shade of grey which she had contrived to impart to the walls of her room. It was little comfort to her that all the other sisters had the same difficulties to afflict them. The people of Selindres were not ungrateful for the sisters' presence, for they had heard what powers the devoted followers of Shalia had to cure the sick and ease pain. Mother Thalinda received a steady stream of pleas for aid, which never went unanswered, though no price was asked for such assistance, the villagers began to send gifts of food and livestock, and by this means the sisters acquired a flock of chickens and a milking goat. They also became inheritors of the rich tradition of cautionary tales and rumours which had been handed down to the people from the times when Chemist Kazula had been their oppressor. Among these stories, there were the usual horrific accounts of cannibalism and child sacrifice, which inevitably accumulate about those of sorcerous inclination, and the usual flights of fancy regarding storm-riding demons and monsters of the night. But there were other items, too, more unusual and idiosyncratic, some of which were contained in sayings and warnings, whose import was no longer properly understood. One apparently pointless tale alleged that Chemist Kazula had made alliance with a tribe of dwarves, which had forsaken the worship of Grungni in order that another god might teach them the secret arts of crystal-making. And one mysterious instruction, known to every child in Selindrei, though none knew what it meant, bade all who dared to walk upon the mountain slopes to beware the golden light which floods the hidden valleys of the soul. The sisters of Shalia were no ordinary women, but they shared the delight which all women have, which men also share, if the truth be admitted, in fearful fancies and ominous whispers. They repeated these tales avidly to one another while they worked, and though they laughed to show what little fear they had of the demons with which long-dead Chemist Kazula had once made pacts, there was always a tiny thrill of anxiety in their laughter. Although work still remained to be done on the houses when the sisters had whitened their walls and inscribed the sacred symbols of their faith, plans had already been made for the erection of the temple. After careful consultation with the masons, Mother Thalinda had decided that this should be sited on a square platform overlooking a steep and densely thicketed slope. Here, the eastern tower of Chemist Kazula's fortress had stood, and the first task facing the temple builders was clearing the rubble from the site. There were few huge stone blocks here, but there was a great accumulation of smaller debris, which had long been overgrown by mosses, lichens, and ferns. Once the obscuring cloak of vegetation had been stripped away, it quickly became clear that there might be useful things to be gleaned from the wreckage. No doubt the people of Selindrei had made some effort over the years to search for weapons and items of commercial value, but they had not troubled to steal away such commonplace things as wooden bowls and clay goblets, or bronze cooking implements and copper sewing needles, for which the thrifty sisters of Shalia could easily find a use. Mother Thalinda therefore appointed sisters Adalia and Columella to the task of sifting through the debris, as it was exposed and cleared, to recover and repair anything which could be put to use. This was a duty which Sister Adalia found at first to be much more to her taste than fetching and carrying. It was far less wearying, and the pleasurable possibility that a new discovery might at any time be made was ample compensation for the dullness of most of the work involved. The work had its less pleasant side, for the artifacts buried in the rubble were sometimes to be found in association with grisly reminders of the fierce conflict which had raged within the fortress when Lanval invaded it. But Adalia was not afraid of skulls and skeletons, and parchment-like fragments of skin. It was not Adalia herself who discovered the first pieces of coloured glass. They were brought to her by a workman who thought them odd, though he did not realise that they might be valuable. But the glassworker's daughter knew well enough how rare and precious stained glass is, and quickly realised that the fragments must have come from a window. She demanded to be taken to the place where the shards had been found, where she began to rummage about for others. When she found several more shards, some the size of fingernails and others the size of copper coins, she immediately commanded the workman to set aside his spade and proceed more carefully. She asked him to collect all the pieces of glass which he could find, and any strips of lead which might have been used to bind them together. In the meantime, she hurried off to tell Mother Thalinda what she had found. Mother Thalinda was less enthusiastic than Adalia expected. Though she was city-bred and had seen stained glass windows in the houses of noblemen, she had never looked at the windows of Quinnell's with the same proud and interested eyes as Adalia. In fact, she considered such decorations to be mere frippery. "I suppose you had better collect all you can," said the superior dismissively, "if it can be of use or value to somebody. Perhaps we can make a gift of it to Lefranc de Valancourt to appease him for the loss of his craftsman. He seemed to be the kind of man who might take pleasure in toys and baubles, and I dare say that he has a clever window-maker at his beck and call." Adalia was annoyed that her discovery should be so casually minimized, and as it seemed to her, her father also. However, she took what had been said to her as permission to make an effort to recover as much of the window as she could. She therefore gave Columella and the workmen instructions to be very careful in working near the spot where the first fragments had been unearthed, and to save all the shards which they found, no matter how tiny. For the rest of that day, and all of the next, she waited fretfully nearby, ready to pounce on any glint of coloured light which showed as the rubble was scraped away from the rock beneath. By the end of the second day, she had hundreds of pieces of glass and dozens of pieces of the lead which had once secured the pattern of the window. The idea was born in her mind that if she could recover a sufficient number of fragments, she might eventually be able to reconstruct the pattern of the window. Enough of it, at least, to know what had been depicted there. She had no delusions as to the difficulty of the project, but she felt compelled to make the effort, so she cleared a space on the floor of her room and began to lay out the pieces there, shuffling them around in the hope that she might begin to see some semblance of order amid the chaos. After an hour's pondering, which somehow used up the time which she should have spent at her private prayers, Adalia was forced to admit to herself that the task seemed hopeless. Although she had collected a good many fragments, many of them quite large, it was obvious that they were only a small fraction of the number into which the window had been shattered. She readily guessed that the vast majority of the remaining fragments must be very tiny, and would be very difficult to recombine, even if they could ever be found. Because she had no idea what the pattern had looked like, it was hard to know where to start in trying to rebuild it. More fragments of coloured glass turned up on the next day, and a few more on the next. But by now the workmen had completed the preparatory work of clearing the site, and it was obvious that no more pieces would be thrown up by the appointed routines of labour. Adalia turned her attention to the heaps of earth which had been shifted from the great platform and to the cluttered slope which descended from its rim. She knew that much of the original rubble from the felling of the tower would simply have been tipped over the edge, and she knew that some of the glass from the window must have gone with it. But the slope was very steep, and the workmen had no intention of clearing the undergrowth from it. Mother Thalinda soon relieved Adalia and Columella of the task of sorting through the debris, on the grounds that everything useful had now been recovered, and gave Adalia, who still seemed too pale and fragile for heavy work, a list of domestic duties to be carried out in the house. Adalia had no option but to accept them, but found that the duties were sufficiently lenient to allow her a few hours of spare time even during the hours of daylight. She began to use these hours in looking for more fragments of glass, wherever she thought they might be found. And she found enough, day by day, to make her feel that it was worth her while to persist in the task. Indeed, she came gradually to believe that she had a special instinct which guided her search, and might eventually bring it to a successful end. As summer gave way to autumn, and autumn to winter, the hours of daylight decreased, and those of darkness expanded. This reduced the amount of time which Adalia could devote to her search for pieces of glass, but increased that which she could devote to the attempt to figure out how the pieces she already had might be connected with one another. This puzzle became very absorbing indeed, so much so that it routinely absorbed the time which should have been given to her devotions. But when Mother Thalinda once suggested to her that she might be neglecting her prayers, she denied the charge vehemently. There were several occasions when she was brought to the brink of despair and became convinced that the project was hopeless. But on each occasion, her half-formed resolution to give it up was subverted by a sudden gleam of inspiration which showed her how a group of pieces might be slotted together, or where a junction in the lead could be reconstructed. 8 years as a servant of Shalya had taught her many things, including the value of patience, and an occasional happy discovery was enough to persuade her that the task should not be abandoned. While the pieces remained scattered on the floor of her room, she could never leave them alone for long, but was always drawn irresistibly back to the puzzle. Her moments of insight gradually accumulated into an emergent understanding of the form and organization of the original work of art. She discovered that the window had been circular, and that there had been several concentric circles within the outer one. She deduced that the paler colored glass belonged mostly to the outer circles, with more vivid blues and roseate shades closer to the center. She realized that the innermost circle had contained a detailed image of some kind, perhaps a representation of a bird with bright plumage. Each of these discoveries reinforced her resolution and encouraged her to increase her efforts, which she began to do by denying herself sleep. It was soon noticed, however, that Adalia burned more candles than any three of her companions, and she was summoned to the superior to explain why this was so. She took Mother Thalinda to see her work, sure that the sight of the partially reconstructed window would be sufficient explanation and excuse. But the superior had no notion of it as an intriguing puzzle to be solved, and could not see the picture emerging within the confused array of lead and glass. Mother Thalinda saw the broken pattern only as a silly and trivial mess, and said so. "You must see, Sister Adalia," she said in a kind and gentle fashion, "that the objective cannot be worth the effort. What could you possibly gain by completing a task whose achievement would bring no worthwhile reward? You must understand that it is not fitting for a priestess of Shalya to become obsessed with worldly things. A window of coloured glass, however beautiful, is only a window on the everyday world. Our concern is to bring the mercy of Shalya to those who suffer grief and pain, not to play with ornaments." Adalia accepted these rebukes very mildly, but her penitence was feigned, and she was glad that Mother Thalinda did not think to offer a specific instruction commanding her to abandon her work. Nevertheless, she did resolve to try harder to perform those observances which her faith required of her. For some days, she was unable to collect more than a handful of very tiny fragments of glass from the slopes beneath the burgeoning temple. Nor, in those few days, did she use more candles than any of the other sisters. But her enthusiasm for her task was not really lessened at all. Almost every piece of glass which she found was now the cause of a tangible thrill, for she was very often seized by the conviction that she knew exactly where her new find would fit into the growing whole. The outer circles of the window came steadily nearer to completion, and she soon redoubled her efforts once again in searching for the missing fragments. When the outer circles had been restored, save for a mere handful of fugitive shards, a more astonishing thing happened. There began to emerge from those outer rings of glass during the hours of deepest darkness, an uncanny glow, which grew by degrees into a flickering, silvery radiance. It was as though the window was no longer laid out on a solid floor at all, but had been set in place to transmit the effulgence of a dawn-lit sky. Had Sister Adalia been less absorbed in her project, she might have been made anxious by this mystery. She might have remembered that this window had not been an ornament in some nobleman's pretty palace, but a part of the fortress of Chemis Cazula, where it might conceivably have had some other purpose than mere decoration. She might even have recalled to mind that curious warning about glorious light, which had passed through the company as an item of idle gossip. Had she been able to think in this way, she would then have understood that her duty to Shalia demanded that she consult her superior at once. But her mind was filled by now with other thoughts and desires, and she had already acquired the habit of secrecy. As things were, the thought which first sprang into her mind when she saw this radiance was that it would help her to save candles, and thus be freed from further pressure to abandon her self-appointed task. Her stratagem worked well. Mother Thalinda was satisfied with what appeared to be a return to normal conduct, and Sister Adalia was trapped in the unfolding web of her deceit, unable now to seek advice about the significance of the eerie light which lit her room for a few hours on either side of midnight. She did not feel as if she was imprisoned by her deceit. Indeed, she felt more contented than she had ever been before. It was as if that emptiness within her being, of which she had only been half aware, had been filled as neatly and cozily as it could be. She was now possessed of a completeness which all her sincere and heartfelt prayers to Shalia had somehow never provided for her. Most of the pieces of glass to which her instinct led her as she patrolled the slopes beneath the temple were rosy or blue in colour, and the reconstruction of the circles where they belonged soon progressed to the point where almost every piece could be put unhesitatingly into place. And as these inner circles neared completion, they began to add their own measure to the light which poured into Sister Adalia's room in such a magical fashion. Adalia loved that light, which was certainly very beautiful, and delighted in studying its many changes. It was not in the least like true sunlight, for it had a ceaseless ebb and flow in it. What had earlier been a casual flickering was now a more tempestuous agitation. Whenever she knelt beside the window, bending over it in search of the place where a particularly problematic shard belonged, her many shadows would move on the whitened walls behind her, like a troop of wild dancers, capering about a magical fire. The dingy walls of her room were quite transformed by the light of the window. Their greyness was utterly banished by it, and the sacred symbols of Shalia's worship were completely blotted out. So too was the dreary greyness of her habit redeemed, for the light made it blaze with brightness, as though it were not a priestess's robes at all, but the coloured costume of some mighty wizard of the colleges. Of the figure in the centre of the picture, however, Adalia could as yet see almost nothing. There were only a few fugitive pieces of glass which seemed to belong there, which gave the merest impression of a feathery form, without any proper indication of the configuration of the wings, nor the least sign of beak or eye. No light came, as yet, from the innermost circle of the window. Adalia's quest was nearly brought to an abrupt conclusion, when Sister Penelope and Sister Mirica, who chanced one night to be out and about at an unusual hour, reported seeing strange lights in her window. Adalia was summoned yet again to see the superior. She became very anxious, lest it be commanded that her work must cease, and she stoutly denied that anything unusual had occurred. She insisted that she had been asleep at the time the light was reported, and knew of no possible source from which it could have come. Because Penelope and Mirica could offer no tentative explanation of their own, Adalia's word was accepted. But Mother Thalinda took the opportunity to question her further about the fate of the stained glass which she had collected. Adalia denied that she was any longer interested in the reconstruction of the window, and said that in any case no sizable pieces of glass had been found for some considerable time. Because the latter part of the statement was true, the whole was believed. After this interview, Adalia took the precaution of hanging up a dark cloth to curtain the narrow window of her room while she worked, and always left the greater window on the floor, covered by a rug when she went out. That Mother Thalinda believed Adalia's story was due in part to the conviction with which she told it, but also to the fact that she seemed so healthy and cheerful nowadays that it was impossible for any of her fellows to believe that she was going without sleep. When the sisters had come to Selindres, and for some time after, Adalia had been pinched of feature and pasty of face, and far from being the strongest of the company. But now her skin was tanned and lustrous, and her laughing eyes were as bright as a bird's. Her companions could only think that it was the sunlight and the air, and the hard but willing labour, which were at long last changing her for the better. Adalia no longer fell eagerly upon the few tiny slivers of glass which were occasionally found while work on the temple proceeded. Indeed, she professed indifference to them. One way or another, though, the fragments disappeared into her sleeves and pockets, and were carried anxiously at the end of each evening's communal rituals to the privacy of her room. There the periphery of the innermost circle was slowly filled in, and she waited with rapt anticipation for the vital moment when the light which streamed through the outer circles would spread to the centre, when that enigmatic image would, as she thought of it, catch fire. She lived for that day. Nothing else seemed to matter at all. Unfortunately, the central motif remained irritatingly absent. There were a few fragments of glass which seemed to represent feathers, and enough lead to imply that the figure was the head of a bird. But of the beak and eyes, there was still no trace. By now, she had searched every inch of the slope beneath the burgeoning temple most assiduously, and she knew that there was little hope of finding anything but tiny fragments there. Without the vital pieces, there was little more of the puzzle to be done, and nothing to occupy her hands and mind in those hours when the light of another world filled her room with its gorgeous colours. Her old habits reasserted themselves, but when she prayed, without taking care to specify which deity it was to whom she addressed her prayers, she prayed only for a gift and a revelation. Her prayers expressed the yearning of her obsessive heart, which had no other object of affection than the face in the centre of the window. For 7 times 7 nights, the light waxed and waned, and each time it died, Adalia went meekly to her bed. But on the next night, she was so filled with the glory of the light that she was utterly entranced, and was driven out by the fierceness of her hunger, out of her room, and out of the house. Winter had come by now, and the night was bitter. Snow was falling on the slopes, its whiteness all but invisible in the cloudy night. But she could not feel cold at all, and made her way unerringly to the site of the temple, which was nearly complete. In the courtyard of the temple, someone was waiting for her. He carried no lantern, and she could not see his face, but she knew by his stature and his voice that he must be a dwarf.
I have something which you want, he said, and you have something which my master desires. Will you make a contract of exchange, so that your heart's desire might be answered?
I will, she said. She felt as though she was lost in a dream, and in dreams one does not ask too many questions.
Here is what you need, said the dwarf,
and she felt a rough and hairy hand as he gave her a parcel of rags, which had something hard and sharp-edged within it. As the other turned to go, Adalia said, Take whatever I have to give in return. And he replied,
It is already taken.
Then she took the parcel back to her room and carefully hid it away before she went to sleep. On the next night, when all had become quiet, she uncovered the window to let free its turbulent light and took out her prize. She carefully unwrapped the bundle, exposing 50 pieces of coloured glass and a few twisted slugs of lead. The fragments of glass were mostly small and misshapen, and it was clear that it would be no easy task to fit them together in the correct order. It had been a long time since she had so many new shards to work with, and she was delighted by the challenge. Her nimble fingers began the work of turning and sorting, flying as though impelled by an intelligence other than her own. And she felt, meanwhile, as though she was laughing inside. She was very quick in slotting the pieces into place, for each one seemed to know exactly where it belonged. The eyes she placed last. And when she placed them, she knew that her work was finished, that although 100 tiny cracks and crannies remained in the grand design, she had done enough. Incandescent light spread from the heart of the window, and the figure detailed there was suddenly present in all its resplendent glory. For a few fleeting seconds, she still thought that the figure was the head of a bird, perhaps that legendary firebird which was still occasionally glimpsed above the cliffs of Paravon. Then she thought that it might be the head of a griffin, like the one displayed as a trophy in the great hall of the governor's palace in Quinnell's. While its colours were still limed by curves of clotted lead, it might have been either of those things. But then, as the cataract of light poured through that window between the worlds, the lead which held the pieces of coloured glass seemed to melt and shrivel, so that the image ceased to be an image and became reality. Then she saw that the central figure was neither bird nor griffin, nor any other mere animal intelligence. Plumed and crested with gorgeous feathers he might be, but this was a person whose gaze was brighter with wisdom and knowledge than the eyes of any human or elven being she had ever seen. There was a tiny voice of warning within her, which tried to cry, Demon! In such a way as to make her afraid. But the voice seemed to Adalia to be no more than a tiny echo, feeble and forlorn, and if, as she supposed, it was the last vestige of that love and adoration which she had once given freely to Shalya, then its insignificance now was clear testimony of the transfer of her loyalty to another power. The face which looked at her out of that other world which was so wondrously filled with ecstatic light was incapable of smiling, for the beaked mouth was set as hard as if it was carved from jet, and yet she was in no doubt that he was glad to see her. She was perfectly certain that he longed to enfold her in his feathery embrace, to cover her tenderly with the splendour of his fiery plumage. The sheer beauty of the prospect overwhelmed her, and she threw wide her arms to welcome that transcendent embrace. Behind her, crowded upon the cold and narrow walls of that space, which had been given to her for her allotted share of the world of mortal men, 100 coloured shadows strutted and jostled, utterly unaware of their own thinness and insubstantiality, uncomprehending of the fact that they were mere whimsies of a light from beyond the limits of the earth. Adalia, who had once been a sister of Shalya, gave voice to a liquid trill of pure pleasure. And those eyes, which she had so recently restored to their proper place, focused upon her an astonishing, appalling look of love, which was full of laughter and the joy of life. When Sister Adalia did not appear for morning prayer, Sister Columella and Sister Penelope were sent to inquire whether she was ill. They discovered her naked and supine upon the floor of her room, with her arms thrown wide and her legs apart. It was, they said, as though she had been seared from top to toe by some incredible fire, which had burned her black. The walls of her room and her discarded robe were similarly black and ashen, and embedded in Adalia's vitrified flesh, sparing not a single inch of it, were thousands upon thousands of tiny pieces of glass. These coloured fragments, as Mother Thalinda was able to observe when she was summoned by her horror-stricken messengers, gave Adalia's corpse the appearance of being encrusted with an extraordinary quantity of precious gems. Had they not known that it could not possibly be another, Columella and Penelope told their friends, they might never have guessed that it was poor Adalia. She had been so utterly transfigured by her mysterious death that she might have been anyone at all. One of the oft-returned-to maxims of one of my favourite short fiction podcasts, Pseudopod, is a William Friedkin's quote, "True horror is seeing something approach." At the apex of horror writing, that can refer to the slow, uncertain coming of the something. My favourite pieces of horror filmmaking are probably The Blair Witch Project and The Wicker Man, both stories in which a horrific outcome slowly unfolds before both audience and protagonists. But more widely, this is the format of M.R. James stories like Count Magnus, where the reader is far ahead of the protagonist in knowing what will happen to them, and is forced to watch as their doom closes in on them. I've talked about the concept of inevitability as a theme of Warhammer, and this story toys with that concept too. But, as with so much of Craig's work, it focuses on the personal and the personality-driven. Adalia contains within herself a combination of features that means that this situation will destroy her. The city woman,
sent to a rural location not of her liking, breeding resentment and frustration. The glazier's daughter, proud of her father's work, who happens to end up in a place with a demonically possessed stained glass window. Although this rather raises the question of whether the window is magic or whether the ambient dark magic of the place embodied itself in the form most likely to enable it to sink its claws into the child of the glassmaker who misses her old life. The problem with stories in which you watch something approach is that, when mishandled, it can be very frustrating to watch someone completely fail to work out what the something is when it's completely obvious to the reader. You only see him at night, and he never eats food, and people in the local area keep getting anemia, mate. Come on, connect these dots with me. And the Light of Transfiguration could potentially be guilty of this. You've been sent to renovate Castle Satan, former home of the devil himself. Do you want to start stealing random objects out of the skip and reassembling them in your bedroom? But the story does a very good job of convincing you that Adalia's perception of reality begins to slip almost immediately. And the story rather deftly gives a sense that her capacity for self-determination is giving away at a rate in lockstep with her focus on reconstructing the window. We can see what is approaching her. She genuinely cannot. The other possibility, of course, is that she actually doesn't care what's approaching, because she wants it to approach. The Red Thirst anthology was written roughly contemporaneously to the end of the development of The Lost and the Damned, and the more fleshed-out version of Chaos presented here in that book might have had some influence on Craig. Certainly he went from depicting demons as IDK bird guys or something, to an actual great unclean one, and you could make the case that the iconography in the Chaos window is more explicitly Tzintzian than anything we've seen from him before, but, more substantially, I think that Lost and the Damned grapples in its fiction with why someone might actually choose to engage in Chaos worship. If you are the most destitute in a society, maybe it's better if Prague burns. If you mutate so that you have wings, maybe it's actually freeing to be able to fly. And if you are someone who is of frustrated potential, perhaps it's actually good to be consumed and transfigured by a demon's fiery touch. We don't get a description of her horrified, tortured expression as she realizes she made a terrible mistake. Instead, she's encrusted in jeweled glass and has slipped the restraints of her tawdry life. I mean, don't get me wrong, she's also, like, dead, so it's not like an ideal situation, but I'm not sure that it is the same situation as the one we had last week, where the demon worshipper is begging Sulcan for mercy, or the week before, where a slight transgression gets you torn apart by big-mouthed demon birds. Adalia's trill of pure pleasure suggests that it might all be worth it. A final thing I would say about Brian Craig and Chaos, though, is that he is not amazing at coming up with names for Chaos worshippers. Chemist Kazula isn't Bretonian enough to give him a sense of location, nor strange enough to feel properly chaotic. Craig remains largely uninterested in humans living with the effects of chaos. You're either fine or you're dead. Ultimately, Chemist Kazula is of this vague figure with a name which is the name of two health food products stuck together. Bit of a missed opportunity. For a brief moment, when the dwarf crystal makers who went over to Chaos to improve their crystal making skills was mentioned, I found myself wondering, my God, is this a Doomstones reference? Doomstones being an early 90s Warhammer Fantasy roleplay campaign converted over from a D&D scenario, and featuring as its central MacGuffins a set of powerful elemental crystals. But neither the timing of the crystal production in universe, nor the release date of the books in real life, made this make much sense. Nevertheless, I think a chaos cult of dwarves obsessed with translucent materials makes for a very interesting concept, particularly when a representative of theirs appears to be helping to pull strings for Dahlia. Someone asked recently whether Craig's approach to chaos worship and demons reflected the satanic panic anxiety of the 1980s. I'm not sure if that's always the case. Certainly, this is the most in the style of a secret cult moving against us from the shadows that we ever get out of Craig. Although they are ubiquitous in other parts of the setting. And Craig gives us an interesting take that I would like to have seen more of. This is the last of the Brian Craig short stories we will look at until we come back to those unpublished in the initial run of stories at some point in the future, so it's probably worth thinking about what we feel about them. Overall, I feel like these stories have raised him in my opinion somewhat. The stories are snappy and easy to read. I knew that Craig had a very dry style of writing, a conversational and reserved tone that I think of as emulating a style of weird fiction writers from the 1930s. This is a pleasing pastiche, but also stops us from becoming fully invested in the characters because we so rarely get to hear them speak or hear their inner monologue. Dahlia felt positively 3D in comparison to some of those we've encountered in the past. Craig also does not seem to have fully sunk his teeth into the setting either, and has a tendency to favour the generic or the superficial where a specific and setting-based might be found, and this manifests itself most clearly in a tendency to portray evil and chaos as essentially interchangeable, and as a result to sidestep ideas about mutation and primal cosmic forces. Although we do get a little sense of the warp at the very end of this story. It has made me more enthusiastic about the idea of reading Zaragoz when we'd come to the end of the short stories. Nothing wrong with a bit of pastiche of Poe, and who knows, this in turn might make me curious about Plague Demon, or even Storm Warriors. Although, from everything I've heard about it, probably not. Please feel free to comment on the show in the posts in the Old Hammer, Rogue Trader or Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay First Edition Facebook groups, or to leave a review if you are so inclined. They really do help. Please tell friends if this is the type of thing that might interest them. You could also follow me on Twitter where I post at Lewis Kerno about, well, history, this podcast, RPGs and Turnip 28. Next time, we are going to get far away from the dry and witty observations of Bretonian life and get our assault cannons whirring as we don our Terminator armour and gravelly voices and descend into the Hulk alongside the Deathwing.